Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One. Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Well, we get into everything, but we also talk to an amazing coach, Paul Westhead, who's got a lot of insights about life, and we'll get into that. First, I'll tell you about Pure Talk. If you have a cellular plan with Verizon, AT&T, or T-Mobile, you're paying way too much for the exact same coverage you'd get with Pure Talk. Look where your bill shows the data usage. The average person uses less than 4 gigs a month, but big carriers charge for unlimited data, so of course you're going to pay more. Pure Talk saves the average person over $400 a year. Unlimited talk and text, 2 gigs of data, all just $20 a month. If you go over data usage, they will not charge you for it. Go to puretalkusa.com. Enter the promo code ADAMPODCAST and save 50% off your first month. PureTalkUSA.com, promo code ADAMPODCAST.
From Carolla One Studios in Glendale, California, this is the Adam Carolla Show. Adam's guest today, NBA and WNBA championship coach Paul Westhead, and Australian musician and comedian Tim Minchin. With Gina Grad on news, Bald Brian on sound effects, and now, he's not in traffic, he is traffic. Adam Carolla.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get it on. No choice but to get it on. Mandate, get it on. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for telling a friend. We love that about you, right, Gina Grad?
That's right.
Handball, Brian.
That is incredible.
Paul Westhead, legendary player, was on the Lakers the first year Magic Johnson's rookie season.
Wow. Coached the Lakers, right?
Oh, but he wasn't. I thought you said he was playing when his first year.
No, he coached.
Oh, he was coaching.
He coached him to the first championship with Magic.
Well, there you go.
He's a legendary coach, man. He's got a lot going on.
I just looked down. He's 81 years old. I thought Paul Westhead in my head was 68 or something. So I was doing the player math, but I didn't know he was in his 80s.
Was there any chance you're confusing with Paul Westfall, also a head coach and player in the NBA?
No way I could ever confuse Paul Westhead and Paul Westfall. Come on.
No. I feel bad for mentioning it. Chris, can we get this out?
But yes, that's probably what I'm doing. I don't know. Whenever I hear Paul Westhead, I'm always curious if he's met porn star Peter North.
Yeah, Paul Westfall he's 69.
Yeah, he is.
There you go.
Yeah.
Just a tag team of Westhead and Peter North heading out on the town. I just feel like that's the ladies, look out.
Paul Westhead is always on blocking. I gotta be facing west.
We got your compass covered, ladies. All right, so Paul will be in the show. Tim Minchin will be in as well, comedian and musicteer and musician and all that. All right, let's see. We got a mashup. I have a nice story from last night. I was doing a last minute call to go in and do Tucker Carlson, and they drove the van to my house, the Sprinter van with the setup and everything, and set up in the driveway and all that kind of stuff. By the way, in the pantheon of things, just tell me how this would have worked when you were 14. My son loves Tucker Carlson, and I said to him, you know, I'm doing a hit at like 5:30. It was like 4:30. I said, the Tucker Carlson minivan is in our driveway. Would you like to poke your head in it and just see what it looked like, the scape behind what's on the screen, how it works, where I sit, lay of the land? And he went, I'm good. And he went and he went into his room.
I know Sonny the little Jim Carolla, low pulse, no excitement Jim Carolla. That said, even something he's purportedly into, he should want to know a little more about it.
Well, his pleasure centers have been destroyed.
It's true.
That's number one. Number two, he knows Tucker's not in the van. Right. I guess that's about as far as he got with it. But
not a surprise.
Yes. Could you imagine a 14-year-old version of you doing that with anything?
No. You don't even have to be into it. If you said, in our driveway right now, there's a van that is an entire TV studio, that would blow my mind.
Right.
When I was 14, I had the opportunity to go to the Warriors facility, part of a school project, and I got to see practice. And I was like, oh, could we check out the locker room? Could we check out the press box? Like, I wanted to see like the inner workings of all this cool stuff that we got to see part of on TV, right? Like a fraction of.
Well, it's kind of a, now it's another topic, but curiosity, which I'm always telling everyone about how important that is. What are we doing to curiosity in general when we're bringing the mountain to Mohammed? You know what I mean? Just dial up the food, dial up the entertainment, dial up whatever. Go to Amazon.
TV studio.
Without TV, go to Amazon. Go click on the picture, the thing you want. It'll just show up at your door. Where's the curiosity? So what happens to curiosity in that scenario when you just keep dialing stuff up and it just keeps showing up at your door? Where's the curiosity kick in?
Not so much for curiosity, but for the instant gratification, which is really what you're talking about. You get on Amazon, it comes the next day. The food comes within 20 minutes. Whatever it is, but anticipation has been lessened a lot, I feel like, in our society. I remember when I was 12-ish, 13, I did this thing where you used to, if you were a really big like baseball fan, you would send the card in an envelope with a self-addressed stamped envelope to the team's like mailing address. And if you were lucky, 3.5 months later, your favorite player would send back an autographed baseball card. And I would like wait by the mailbox every day because I had sent these things out in May and here it was like August. I'm like, oh, we're going to be getting some autographs soon. I got a few, like a handful, but that was the anticipation. You know what I mean? It wasn't the next day, obviously. It was months later. I'm like, oh, I know it's coming.
Well, delayed gratification, to be sure, is dead in a ditch by the side of the road. But now I'm worried about curiosity because I think they both sort of, with one goes the other. Like, you just, kids just don't need to be that curious anymore. Stuff is just there. By the way, there's more entertainment in Sonny's room than there is in the Sprinter van in the driveway of my house.
That's true.
So,
and to combine those thoughts, if it takes too long to find out the answer, you're no longer curious.
Yeah, you lose interest.
Right. So for me, what was in my room growing up was there was no competition. I didn't have an oscillating fan in my room to entertain me. There was no TV. There was no anything. So everything outside of my room became interesting and curious. Anyway, a nice story, which is last minute, I did Tucker. And I was sitting eating dinner about 7:30 at night, and Olga got a text from her daughter that a client of hers, she's a hairstylist, just saw me on Tucker and was laughing her ass off. And she needed this laugh because she found out in July that her daughter of 11 years, 11-year-old daughter, has terminal brain cancer.
Oh, Jesus.
And she's a physician. So she's a physician. She knows
it's the curse of knowing too much.
I do. Mm-hmm. I always hope when that kind of stuff happens, I always hope for the like uneducated, super religious, like Guatemalan grandmother who's sitting there rubbing rosaries and talking like she doesn't know what's going on exactly. Yeah. She's a physician. She knows what's going on. They found out on her 50th birthday, her daughter had this terminal brain cancer.
And so she, nice story.
She wrote me. So she said, thank you. I haven't laughed in months. And that really made me laugh. And I thought, God, that's nice. And then I thought, I should send her a book or something. So I went and found a book.
You told Sonny, he was like, yeah, what? So what?
Yeah, big whoop. So I went and signed a book or whatever. And then I said to Olga, I said, hey, why don't you let me talk to her? Get Paola, your daughter. I said, see if you can get her number.
Good for you.
Said, okay. So I get the number, Evidently, Paula didn't tell her I was going to call, which probably would help. So I called. Well, no, she couldn't have told her I called. Ask Emmy if Paula. I don't think Paula relayed that. She just went, here's her phone number. I don't know. It's kind of old school, I guess. Nowadays, yeah. You do it a little different way. But she said, here's her phone number. I said, okay. And I called. And nobody picked up. And then I called again and nobody picked up. And I was kind of wondering, like, is it the unknown number thing that the person is getting?
Sure, mean you very likely.
Meanwhile, she's 50, again, found out on her 50th birthday in July. Daughter, I don't know, not a lot of time to live, 11 years old, physician. And then she's having to do all that with this, all this COVID business going on, right. All these protocols and everything. So the third time I call her, and she picks up, but she does the suspicious answer. Hello? You know, mm-hmm. Like weird voice. I don't know this is voice. And I said, hey, it's Adam Carolla. And she was just fucking had the time of her life. And wow. We had a long conversation and we just, you know, talked about everything. And I thought, and she has all my books. She reads all the books. She loves all the books. She tells other people that she works with and blah, blah, blah. But I thought, you know, I don't know why this is it's the most gratifying part about being a public figure. Mm-hmm. And it's really the easiest. A lot of this stuff is a pain in the ass. We're like, you got to go down to Norwalk and stand in front of the B. Daltons for 2 hours and sign. You know, that's a pain in the ass. Mm-hmm. This is easy. It's really easy. I was on the phone with her for about 20 minutes. I probably got more out of it than she did, for sure. And, well, I can't say for sure, but, I mean, she was like, I read every one of your books, and okay. Paula sent her a text, but only after she talked to me.
Okay.
So she sent her a text.
Adam's going to call anytime. Be ready.
She'd be a great co-pilot. I was going to put the landing gear up. I was going to put the landing gear down, but I was going to do it after we landed. I was going to wait till we got onto the ground.
No, I meant after Paula talked to you.
Oh.
After Paula talked to you, she said she sent her friend 10 to 15 minutes. 10 to 15 minutes later.
I must have just called her immediately then. That's what happened. I just called her. So
and
anyway.
To be fair to Paula, she does a hell of a head of hair. You're looking at
she
her
does.
Right now.
She does. Yeah, she's great. So she said, I get your books and I read 2 pages a night just to save it for the next day. I don't want to read it all the way through at once.
Delayed gratification.
That's right. And then I kind of told her, well, you want to know how the whole thing works. Like, how does it work? Like, how do you know when you're going to go on or what subjects you're going to talk about or how it physically works, where you go or you mic up or you have the earpiece with a delay or you can't see Tucker. You can only hear him because he's on if you saw him, the delay would screw you up. Anyway, we had a lovely conversation everyone, look, again, the part of life where people want you to give generously and you got to get out your checkbook or drive over there and do that or, you know, spend all day at the soup kitchen. God love you. But a lot of this kind of stuff, you don't have to be a celebrity. A lot of these kinds of things are kind of free. They're pretty easy. Yeah. There's not much behind them. There's not much to think about.
And also get paid emotional dividends. Like you said, sorry to interrupt, Gina, but it's emotionally gratifying. You know what I mean? Being able to talk to somebody or make their day or give them a little bit of hope or a smile or whatever. It's gratifying.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, if you could ask this woman, what would you want more than anything? I think 20 minutes to not be in complete depression and terror would be right up there. And that's what you gave her.
Well, I'm a hero, and we wish
God has a phone.
We wish Brandy and her daughter well.
Amen.
All right, let's see what did I write down here? All right, let's see. We have a Dawson mashup. So says Dawson.
Oh. Yeah, you remember the reporter in Anchorage, Alaska?
Maria Athens.
Who loves herself almost as much as she hates the mayor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I figured it was worth listening to her again, but against the light rock of Bertie Higgins.
Mm. Ethan, it's Maria Athens from Fox ABC CW News at National Alaska. I just learned through my Emmy award-winning journalism, you're also a pedophile and like little girls and children. And there's a website. I'm so fucking exposing you. I'm going to get an Emmy.
Wrapped around each other.
So you either turn yourself in.
Trying so hard to stay.
Kill yourself.
That first cold winter together.
Or do what you need to do.
Lying in each other's arms.
I will personally kill you and Mark Kimmel, my goddamn self.
Those old movies. Falling in love so desperately.
You Jewish piece of living fucking shit.
Honey, I was your hero.
You have met your match, motherfucker.
And you were my leading lady.
I'm gonna get an Emmy.
We had it all.
You have met your motherfucking match.
Just like Bobby and McCall.
I can't believe I am such a good person.
Starring in our own late, late show.
And thought I loved you.
Sailing away to Key Largo.
I fucking hate, I don't even hate you.
Here's looking at you again.
I will pray for your Zionist.
Listen to all the things we did.
Fucking ass, you piece of shit loser.
You'll find it once again. Hello.
Kill yourself?
Just like they did in Key Largo.
I'm putting this on the news tonight. Bye! Have a great Friday, you motherfucker.
Dawson, can you get to that last drop for me?
That is a great mashup there, Dawson. You hit it out of the ballpark. All right, let's see. We got, all right, let me hit Geico here. Yeah, Geico, man. It's fall. Yeah, it's actually starting to feel a little like fall out there.
Yeah.
And that means it's Geico weather out there, taking scenic drives, hitting the road finally, not baking out in the hot sun. And one of my favorite stories was, we haven't told in a million years, was going to Lime Rock. So I was thinking about this. And the reason I was thinking about this is because I got Paul Newman's car. I got his, it's a Ford Escort. A Ford Escort that Paul Newman drove in 1973. At Lime Rock, and I took a little. There's some footage on the internet, and I'll show you the car going around the track. But it was Newman Lime Rock, 1973, and there's old footage of him driving this car around the track in Lime Rock and getting out of the car. And actually, another driver was driving it, and then Paul's car broke, and for the race. Tom Ciccone, I think, was driving it, and then Paul's car broke, and so that Tom Ciccone went, you want to drive my car? And Paul said, yeah, can I get into your car? So this guy and Paul walked over to Tom's car, this Escort, this latest car I got in the Newman collection, and he climbed into the Escort and then drove the Escort around Lime Rock. Lime Rock was Paul's home track. It's a very small, tight little track, and it's
a very small little car.
It's a small little car and a small little track, and it's tucked up into in I guess it's in Connecticut, I think. But anyway, do you have the actual car, Max Zapata? So this is a car that's been floating around for a while. Older gentleman had it, been wanting to sell it to me for a long time, and he wasn't done using it, and now he is. Hey, Max Bear, remember we're going to connect those two?
I have them here. We had a last minute. I sent Kalen home, so I'm getting all the stuff.
Oh, okay.
He went home last second.
Is he okay?
He's all right. He was just getting a little worried, so I just told him it's fine.
He was worried about.
He was getting a little anxious. He wasn't. He was really tired today, like unusually more tired than he normally is.
He was more tired than he normally is.
Yeah, one where it kind of freaked him out. So I just told him to go home.
Okay. Well, tell him to hang out until the first part of the show's done next time. All right. Anyway, I was trying to connect these ideas, but the car's now, you can get a better shot. The car's just sitting in the shop now, and it's, you just go to the first one, and that's, there you go. There it is. The old car is there. I have it. And Newman was driving around Lime Rock in that thing, and it reminded me of when me and who went? Me, August, Nate, when we're doing the Newman doc.
Yep, you've just named it, although I believe Nate went up a little early with a crew, so it was just you, me, and August in the car.
We had to go to Lime Rock to film a couple of drivers when we're doing the Newman doc, and we also went to Bob Sharp's house, who was Newman's team owner, who's also in the neighborhood. And that day, what was that day like for you?
It was definitely one of the craziest days of my life. A much shorter backstory. My friends had pranked me.
Oh, right.
In the trip to New York. So I did not bring the right shoes with me.
Right. You, had dress shoes. Right.
It's a very long story, but I just really didn't think this through. And I'm wearing dress shoes on this hot track trying to help set up the film crew. But prior to that, when we were driving through the windy back roads of Connecticut trying to get to Bob Sharp's house, Mike August was, of course, the driver. And if I'm not mistaken, we were also in the early stages of you working on President Me, one of your books.
So I
was in the back seat reading the book out loud, which I can't even do on a straight road, let alone a winding road. And when we got to Bob Sharp's house, I have never been sicker in my entire life.
I start off that morning doing Howard Stern at like 6 a.m.
Hell of a day.
So I started off, we start off in New York. I did Stern. Did you come with me to Stern?
I did, yeah. I think I blacked out. I don't even remember that part of the day.
We started with Stern.
Yeah, like 6 a.m.
Then we jumped into a rental car. Then we drove back roads to Connecticut and to Bob Sharp's house. And Bob Sharp's house, like, up a steep driveway, and he's got a bunch of stairs that go up, and Matt's got his floor shims on, and Nate's telling him, grab the C-stand and the battery box and go up to the top. Like, we're filming at the very top where Bob's office was. Matt's sweating profusely. By the way, I think we stopped at Lime Rock first. We filmed as fast as we could for an hour and a half, and then we jump back, and now we're on the clock. We hustled the Sharps. And by the way, we were leaving from Kennedy that evening, and we had that. Matt, Mike didn't really seem to be empathic as to the pain you're going. Matt was sweating profusely, and I would say he was laboring.
Yeah, he was slipping and sliding in those fucking shoes.
He was like
shoes.
Trying to go up the stairs, and Nate and Mike are all like gym coach from junior high. You know, it's like, hey, step it up, let's go, grab the battery. They have no idea. I could see his face, just sweat pouring, beet red, feet sliding around the steps, and. Did we end up making it out of New York that night?
Well, we did barely because it was supposed to be, let's just say it was a 90-minute drive, and we had approximately 89 minutes, you know, with which to accomplish that. And a gigantic truck tried to get under a bridge
and actually
got lodged into the bridge.
Wow.
I mean, you could imagine this. So it's like we're like, look, we go from New York, we drive from Manhattan, from Howard Stern's place. We go from Manhattan. We go to Connecticut. We go to Lime Rock. We'll be there by noon. We'll shoot from noon to 2 there. Then we pack it in, and we hustle to Bob Sharp's house. And then we'll get there at 3. And then we got from 3 to 5 to shoot there. We have an 8 o'clock flight out of Kennedy, but we can make it in 95 minutes through the back roads. And Mike's driving like a maniac. And Matt's green. And there's one highway from Connecticut that goes through. And of all things, a fucking truck literally wedges itself under the overpass. And we're just stopped, and everyone's just staring at the clock. Like, this is the world's longest day, and we ain't getting on that plane.
So then we get to this scenario, which you recently experienced, I believe, in Salt Lake, where somebody has to return the rental car.
That's right.
And so, of course, I'm going to be the one to do that. I dropped you guys off.
That was in Oakland, but go ahead.
Oh, right. Sorry. So you guys got to go into your, the VIP lounge at the airport, and I'm still sliding around in my dress shoes all over the airport. And my one great moment, though, was that I did also get in to that VIP club at the airport without having paid for it, because I was wearing an Adam Carolla t-shirt. And I think he saw the green in my face, and he just was nice enough to let me in.
And the dress shoes.
I was dressed for the occasion.
Belong.
That was a fucking 17-hour day. Anyway, eventually we got on that flight.
We all did, somehow.
I sort of remember that as being one of those flights where it was delayed, and every once in a while you get that passenger who does the, after it's delayed, you know, another 20 minutes, they go, that something where that passenger goes, like, this is bullshit, like, no more, or something, like, let's rally, and it's like...
Yeah. Storm the castle.
And do what? There's a mechanical thing or something's going on. I don't know why. What would you like me to rage against? Which machine would you like me to rage against?
They can't stop us all.
Yeah, it's like, remember that guy?
Oh, I will never forget that guy. It really was like, who's with me? Who's with me?
Yeah, let's take a Greyhound bus and a scant 77 hours. We'll be back in Burbank. It's like, yeah, we're going to... The flight's going to be delayed another 45 minutes, and then we're going to land at LAX. Or we could, storm the castle with you. All right. Thank you for that. And visit Geico.com today. Switch your insurance and make it easy. 15 minutes. Save 15% or more at Geico.com. All right. Let's see. We got Paul. Paul's on hold already? Yes, go ahead.
Oh, yes. Oh, he's on hold already. Go ahead. But I pulled a clip of the famous Hank Gathers incident. Paul was the coach at the time. I don't know that he wants to, how much he wants to talk about it. I thought it might be good to play it. We could discuss it briefly if we have time. Because Gina has no
idea. I'm, of course, in the dark. Yeah.
Let's do that now. What? Well, you're saying he's on hold, but you're also saying at 1:35. So it's. Which one do you want to go with?
Oh, sorry. He was. I just put that on the top. I think he's on hold. We have the name on the Zoom account is just guest, so I'm assume this is him. But usually they put their name.
Oh, okay. Well, why don't we? Let's talk about the Hank Gathers thing first. Go ahead, set the table.
Okay, this is totally off memory because I was looking him up today and I was like, oh God, he was coach of LMU, Loyola Marymount out here, college coach after he was with the Lakers in the late 80s up till 1990. And that was a very good LMU team in 1990. They had two really marquee players, Hank Gathers and Bo Kimble. Hank Gathers, I saw the 30 for 30 on this team, on Paul Westhead and this team. Very fascinating. I was 12 years old at the time, so I was really into, this whole phenomenon. They were really good, and they're not a powerhouse, right? They're not a powerhouse. It wasn't like, oh, North Carolina, good again, Duke, good again. No, LMU kind of came out of nowhere with these two real marquee players. Long story short, Hank Gathers had some sort of heart problem, like he has like a defective, some sort of something going on. They put him on some medication. He didn't like how the medication made him feel and play. He thought he was sluggish. He thought he was lethargic. So I believe he went off the medication. Again, this is from memory, so correct me if I'm wrong. And at that point, playing a basketball game, during a college game, Division I college game, he collapsed on the floor and died on the court.
Oh, God.
There's footage, which I pulled if Chris has time to play it, but it's harrowing.
Yeah, he literally died in the middle of a game.
Skip ahead a little bit.
And
he had just made a spectacular alley-oop dunk. And
he just fell over and he just died on the floor.
Oh, my God. And he's seizing.
And he was a spectacular athlete. He would have been a first-round pick for sure. He was,
wait, he's up?
I don't know, 6'8" or 6'10". He was a brick shithouse.
He sits back up and just proclaims, I don't want to lie down, and then ends up lying down again and eventually dies.
Oh,
and if I remember well, then his teammate is the one who shot the basket with his eyes closed.
Yeah,
right. The free throw.
No. He shot it left-handed in tribute. Bo Kimble left-handed in tribute to Hank Gathers.
Thank God he made it.
And they wanted. This is shocking that it hasn't been made into a movie because they ended up going on a unbelievable run in the tournament in the March Madness tournament. They made it all the way to the round of eight or something and lost to eventual national champion UNLV. But they upset defending champions Michigan. Like there was a really heartfelt, spectacular run for a great team.
Well, we will. Paul's on hold, so we can talk to him about that as well as many other things in the NBA. We'll take a quick break. We'll be back with Paul Westhead right after this.
And now, Alcoa presents Definitely Not a Jew on the Adam Carolla Show.
Bristol, Tennessee. A 76-year-old man lost one of his legs after his son drove over him with a lawnmower. The son hit him with the lawnmower because the 76-year-old man was attacking him with a chainsaw. Definitely not a Jew.
Paul Westhead is on the line. The Speed Game, My Fast Times in Basketball. It's available November 1st. You can pre-order it now on Amazon, if you would, please. Good to see you, Paul.
Oh, thanks, Adam. I appreciate it.
Congratulations on an incredibly diverse career. I mean, NBA championship, WNBA championship, NBA championship as a player in the NBA. I mean, let's unpack that, and then we'll get into many other things. So for you, where do you grow up? Where do you hail from?
Well, I was born and raised in Philadelphia, and so I'm a Philly guy.
That could be. Is that your phone ringing?
That is my phone ringing.
That's all right.
Mitch Kupchak.
Mitch Kupchak famously, and
Mitch,
I don't.
Kupchak just called.
I don't know if you guys know, or Paul. I'm curious what you know, but Mitch. I have a very vivid memory of Mitch Kupchak in the lock. I guess he was a forward for the Lakers in the 70s. Yes.
Yeah. I was the one who brought him there.
Mitch Kupchak. In the locker room after the Lakers game, while somebody was being interviewed in front of the camera, behind the camera, Mitch stood up on the bench because I guess he didn't want the athlete's foot or something, and proceeded to drop his jock and his shorts. I remember that very clearly when I was 9 years old. Is that possible?
Well, that doesn't sound like Mitch Kupchak, but... because he really was a straightforward, good guy. So he probably didn't realize that there were people or cameras or young boys in there.
I didn't. No, that's the whole thing. He thought he was off of the camera. I don't think he did it. I don't think he checked his cup intentionally for the camera. Though I understood it as he thought he was off camera. So
that was Kurt Rambis.
That was Kurt Rambis.
Yeah, that sounds like him.
So you grow up in Philadelphia.
Yeah, I'm. I was born and raised in Philly. I went to high school there. Played at St. Joseph's University for Jack Ramsey in my college basketball career. Wasn't a star. My grade point average was better than my points per game average. That's because I was a good student, though. I had a 3.4 grade point average.
So then what led you into coaching from that?
Well, I always wanted to be a teacher. So I was involved, I did teacher ed, and I was qualified and certified to be a high school teacher. I had an interest in basketball, and my first opportunity came up to be a teacher and a coach, and it didn't work. And I remember I asked Jack Ramsey to call and make a recommendation for me, and he said, Paul, I'm going to call for you. He said, but you're really not a coach. He said, you're a teacher, but I'll make the call. The irony of that is that years later, I coached against Jack Ramsey in the NBA, and, we became lifelong friends. But I think he saw me more as somebody that was better in the classroom than on the basketball court, because he saw me as a player.
Well, when did you start thinking about the up-tempo game? I mean, that's kind of, I guess you'd be the grandfather or the father of the quick possession, high octane. don't follow your shot kind of up-tempo game. Is that something that you conceived when you were playing or were watching? When, how'd that work?
Yeah, well, certainly not when I was playing, because if you played for Jack Ramsey, he was a proponent of doing everything right and on time and exact. And we played sometimes a little fast, but not the speed that I did. So I got it a couple ways. One, I spent the 70s coaching in the summer in San Juan, Puerto Rico. And in the Puerto Rican league, the quick shot was routine. You know, there was no, you know, set up the offense and run the flex or something. So I fell into a style of play in a league that I was interested in already. So I became a fast break person. Then I came back to my LaSalle college teams and tried to run with them. I ran into a coach from Old Dominion University, Sonny Allen, who was a fast break guy, gave me some of his scheme. He did say to me, "Paul, if you're going to follow my scheme, you're going to have to be a little crazy." I said, "Well, I can do that." And everything evolved from there. I mean, once you get bit by the fast game, the speed game, it's hard to go back. Basketball becomes boring if you don't run fast.
Is there any – there's no team that doesn't work the speed game in the NBA, no college, major college. Everyone does it. Our high school does it now. So it's ubiquitous. Does it – here's an interesting question. Obviously, when you have great players that can move it up and down – and amazing specimens, your Magic Johnsons or your LeBron James or something. It's great. But does it benefit the game with the greatest athlete, or would it benefit a shorter, slower team even more? Because I could make an argument for why those guys wouldn't want to set up and post up and play a slow game.
Well, it's kind of interesting. At the end of the day, Adam, the running game done the way I coached, namely if we had the 100 offensive possessions, we ran 100 times, is not a good thing for players in general. They don't want to do that. It's too hard. They don't want to work that hard every time. So when you get great players, you know, like Magic and Kareem, or, you know, the Michael Jordans of my day, they don't want to play real fast because they're saying, why do I want to go fast when I can take my time and score anyway? So what's the point of this? So your second notion, I think, is sound. Lesser players, slower players, less talented players should want to play fast because it could give them an advantage. And yes, I coached some teams that was what my selling point was. If we ran the break and shot in 4 and 5 seconds all the time, we would wear down better, more talented, bigger teams. But even then, they have to buy in, because if you don't, the fast break fails.
Is it easier to coach men or coach women?
Tell me the talent level and I'll give you an answer. I mean, because it really comes down to that. But in general, it's easier to coach women because they follow your direction almost exactly. When I coached in the WNBA in the Phoenix Mercury, we acquired a point guard. Her name was Kelly Miller. She was from the University of Georgia. She played for Andy Landers, and she was a very good player. I said, "Kelly, I want you to run the ball. You're going to be my point guard. I want you to run the ball as fast as you can every possession." She said, "Okay, I can do that." And for 2 years, in every practice, in every drill, in every game, she went breakneck speed down the court with the ball. I mean, it's hard to get men to to follow that direction and never waver. They're always want to try to figure something out. She said, "You want me to do that? I can do that." And
is she single?
I think she is single. Yeah.
I want some lasagna, lickety split. You understand?
Oh, she'd take care of that. Yeah.
Yeah. It must be difficult for the elite players to train. I mean, you got to run practice hard, right? I mean, you got to run up and down the court, just back and forth. I mean, you're asking multi-million-dollar guys to do these jingle jangles all day. Is that difficult?
That is very difficult, and you're spot on. They want to play. They want to win. They want to get a better contract. You know, if their contract's up in a year or two, but they really deep down don't want to run extra fast, and no, they sure don't want to run extra fast all the time.
No, so yeah,
it's a hard sell, and that's why, and it's in my book. That's why I had 20 jobs, and I got fired in 14 of them.
In general, it's hard to get really tall people to do what you want anyway. Like, you ever walk up to a guy 6'9" and go, "Hey, pick that up. It's going to fuck you." Like, it's hard to get tall guys to do your bidding, number one. Number two, rich and tall, like millionaire and tall. That's strike two. And yes, you're so right. I was just sort of putting myself back in Pop Warner football and high school football days. There is such a difference between jogging up and down or kind of doing a lap at the park or lap. You know, you'd get into football practice, like, do a warm-up lap. Everyone do a warm-up lap. You know, at the end, we're going to run some laps. The wind sprint thing, like when you're going hard, it takes it out of you fast. It's like you have a battery in you, and that battery will last for 2 hours, but you can run it dry in 5 minutes if you just punch it. And that's what that is. Yes, Brian.
Remember the I'm sure is now not allowed, but the Indian run, where the whole group had to run, the last guy had to get to the front, then the last guy had to get to the front, right? But you'd be running the entire time. Those mm-hmm. were torturous.
Yeah, well, I didn't quite do that, but we did. Our practices were not stand around half court talking about how to run pick and roll. Our practices were transition, so everything was offense, defense, offense, defense, offense, defense. I will say, though, I did have an experience with Kareem that I learned from him. We started the season training. We were in Palm Springs, California. And I had a 2-hour practice, first practice, and, you know, was doing fast break, and guys worked hard and were pretty tired. And at the end of practice, as a lot of high school college coaches do, I ran what they call murder or suicide or lines. They go back and forth, up and down the court, maybe 10 times. So I had them do it once, and then we finished. And the team walked to the right to get to the locker room. I walked to the left, and Kareem came over, left with me, put his arm around me, and said, "Paul, I don't do murder." and then he walked away. There was no more conversation. And it's very understanding. He never called me coach. He only called me by my first name. I think he only called John Wooden coach. So
yeah,
we had a practice that night. That's when they did two-a-days, and we went back, and I scratched out the murder-suicide for the night practice, and I never did it again.
Is that him calling you Paul but calling Wooden coach? Is that sort of the equivalent to calling your stepdad dad, but your sister calls him Bert, you know what I mean? Because she doesn't like him.
That's a good comparison. I should have had you with me as my assistant. Maybe I'd have lasted longer in some of these jobs.
I can handle that, Abdul-Jabbar. Well, do a guy like I've interviewed Kareem a number of times. Oh, yeah, there's a picture of us, me interviewing Kareem on this show.
Well, yeah, I see it.
So here's kind of the question. would you rather have a heady, thoughtful, kind of contemplative philosopher type like him? Well, now that guy's not going to, you know, you can't tell him, go dive through that wall for me. He's not going to do it. But he is thoughtful. Or someone who is less sort of, I don't know, thoughtful, less up in their head, more visceral. I don't know. Like, was a guy like Magic Johnson, like, more visceral, and Kareem was more thoughtful? Or in which would you rather coach?
Yeah, well, Kareem, he was a very thoughtful guy, and we would occasionally talk, you know, Shakespeare sonnets and novels and Robert Frost poetry, but he didn't want to talk too much about basketball, and he surely didn't want you to tell him what to do. You see, mm-hmm. Professional coaches, and I learned the hard way, you don't want to walk in and tell 12 NBA players, this is what we're going to do, and I know what I'm saying. They want to kind of go at their own pace and figure things out themselves. So Kareem was easy to coach because he'd go out and get you 22 points and 14 rebounds. So, yeah, I'll take that kind of thoughtful guy any day.
Who were some of the players on the team on the Lakers back then, since I sort of remember all those guys?
Well, obviously Magic Johnson, Norm Nixon.
Oh, yeah.
Jamal Wilkes, who sure. You know, was another UCLA Bruin.
Yeah.
Michael Cooper.
Oh, Coop, yeah.
Mitch Kupchak.
Cooper, was Cooper famously, was he the one who was a virgin until he got married? Or am I thinking of another Laker?
A.C. Green.
Oh, A.C. Green. Damn it. Worthy wasn't around. Was Worthy back then?
No, Worthy came after me. But Worthy was around, yeah. And I didn't have A.C. Green either. He came 2 years after me.
Well, he came 10 minutes after he got married. Go ahead.
I have a related question for the coach. Coach, you coached Chris Jackson in Denver, who later went on to change his name to Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf. And he was very famous, Adam, if you remember. He was one of the first players ever professionally to sit down during the national anthem. And yes. a lot of controversy. Obviously, Colin Kaepernick kind of, you know, became the face of that movement. But I'm curious, did you ever talk to Chris Jackson or Mahmoud about that? Did you ever have a conversation? I know it was after your time, but I wonder if you ever talk to him about it.
Yeah, no, we never had that conversation, but we drafted him when I was in Denver. He was a rookie when I arrived. I was there 2 years with him. And then some of the issues of him not standing up for the anthem, et cetera, came after I left. So after I was dismissed, all of that took place. He was a very interesting young man. He was very talented. As you know, he had Tourette's, and that kind of affected him because sometimes the medication didn't work. And so he had to fight that. But, boy, he was a skilled guy. He just wanted the ball in his hand and leave him alone. He struggled early in his rookie year, so I met with him once. I said, Chris, I'm going to try and help you. I'm going to run some high pick and rolls around half court for you. And he said, no, coach. Just give me the ball and let everybody get out of my way. He said, I play best when I can just do my own thing.
Well,
but he was a nice young man. And I think what happened to him, he was kind of ahead of his times. It was kind of unfortunate.
Yeah, that was years ago. Speaking of great players and medications, we're talking about Hank Gathers. Right before you came up, you were coaching that game. Do you have recollections of Hank and that game and that time period?
Well, it was 30 years ago, and my recollection is like it was 3 minutes ago. Yeah, crystal clear in my mind. We're playing Portland University in the NCAA qualifiers, and Hank makes a thundering slam dunk on offense, and turns around and is running back to play defense and collapses around half court and, you know, never to get up again. And it changed my life and the life of our team. And I think everyone at LMU for a long, long time. It was the hardest thing that ever happened to me in my life, let alone as a coach.
What kind of guy was Hank Gathers?
Oh, he was wild and crazy and vivacious and outgoing. And he'd be doing your show right now. That's what he ultimately wanted to be. He wanted to be a radio TV announcer. And he always would grab a microphone if there was one on a bus, and he'd start making fun of everybody. He was tough, aggressive, but lovable. I'll give you a story to show you what he was really like. After games at home, my 12-year-old daughter would come and stand outside the locker room with me, and the players would come out. She had a crush on our shooting guard, Jeff Fryer, kind of a blonde surfer boy from Corona Del Mar, California. So she's standing there with me waiting for Fryer, and out comes Hank. And he walks over to my daughter, Julie. He says, "Julie, who's your favorite player?" And she says, "You are, Hank." And that's what he was. He made you like him. And there were a lot of reasons to like him. So for him to die so suddenly was like the life just poured out of us.
He certainly would have had a great NBA career. I mean,
yeah, I think he would have been a 10-12-year veteran. I don't think he'd have been an all-star, but he'd have been 12 points, 12 rebounds every game, you know, and help you win. And as you perhaps remember, in his junior year, he did lead the country in scoring and rebounding, which I think has only been done about five times in the history of college basketball.
Were you and the teammates and the team essentially, were you aware that he had passed literally out on the court, or were you see him taken away in an ambulance and could think, well, I hope he's going to be okay?
Well, he did go in an ambulance, and they whisked him away to a local spot in Marina Del Rey, California. The team went into the locker room. I went to the hospital. Obviously, when I got there, they had pronounced him dead, and I saw him on the gurney, et cetera. And this is well before cell phones and everything, so I was the one that had to come back and deliver that news to the team waiting in the locker room.
Hmm. Brian, you had a question?
Obviously, this is during the conference tournament. You have the national tournament coming up, just, I'm assuming, days later. You guys went on a magical run, captured, you know, the nation. It was so heartwarming. Talk about that a little bit, how it felt, how the team felt, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, we all flew back to Philadelphia for the funeral services at the church in North Philadelphia. They had a service at LMU for the student body. And then the players said, "Hey, we want to play." And I think they wanted to play because they were so caught up in the grief of Hank's passing that playing basketball was relief for them. It was a chance to do something other than their grief.
And a very so they specific played. To honor they, that, to honor him.
They played so well. I mean,
inspired.
We won three games, the Michigan game. I mean, we're playing the returning national champions, and we win 149-116.
Wow.
And
that's about a 35-second shot clock, too, right?
Yeah, and it was just – and it was like almost easy for them. And they were doing it for Hank, but they weren't trying to just win. They were just trying to play. And because they were just playing, it became easy.
That, I mean, Hank Gathers would be 50 years old today, right?
Right about there, yeah.
Wow. God, yeah. It was so long. It feels like it was yesterday, but also feels like a million years ago as well. The book, The Speed Game, My Fast Times in Basketball, it's available, like I said, November 1st, but you can pre-order it now on Amazon. Coach, it's been a fascinating discussion.
Yeah, thank you. It's always good to reminisce, and you know, whenever I think of my experience at LMU, it was the best of times and the worst of times.
Charles
Dickens.
Yeah, it really captured the nation, that run you guys went on after Hank passed. It was an incredible time. I haven't thought about it in a million years, but here we are. Thanks, Coach. Paul Westhead.
Everybody. My pleasure.
Thank you,
guys. I appreciate it.
All right. Let me hit Simply Safe here, and then we'll get into Tim Minchin. First, Simply Safe. Most home security companies trap you with high prices, tricky contracts, lousy customer support. There's only one no-brainer. That is Simply Safe. Everything to protect your home. An arsenal of sensors and cameras for every room, window, and door. Tailored specifically for your home. Professional monitoring day and night. Ready to send police, fire, or medical professionals. Set it up and under an hour, just peel and stick. No technician required. No contract, pushy sales guys, none of that. Hidden fees, fine prints. Starts at just $15 a month. U.S. News and World Report named it the best overall home security of 2020. Right, Dawson?
Head to simplysafe.com/Adam and get a free HD camera for our listeners. It's simplysafe.com/Adam to make sure they know our show sent you.
All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back with comedian and actor and writer and musician Tim Minchin right after this.
Hey, movie lovers. Who needs a theater when you have Pluto TV? Grab your popcorn and your streaming device because free movies are here. Pluto TV is your home for movies. Great movies are playing anytime in over 20 exclusive movie channels of action, horror, rom-coms, and more. Watch hits like Saving Private Ryan, Pretty in Pink, and Charlie's Angels all for free. No signups, no fees, no contracts. Ever. Download the free Pluto TV app on any device.